Okay, I'm lucky enough to be able to introduce David to you. David is a tremendous copywriter, plus now a very accomplished author. He recently sent us the rough draft manuscript of the book he's just had published called Million Dollar Marketing Secrets. And I've got to tell you, we do a lot of reading. There's not much that can keep me glued to my seat through a Saturday, but his book certainly did it. It was a tremendous, tremendous marketing book. And David's got a lot of experience and a lot to tell you, so I'll hand over to David.
Thank you. Is this on? Everyone can hear? I guess you realize by now, as Ted was saying, just how meticulous and how thorough Bill and Karen have been in the preparation of this seminar. And I don't know if you know it or not, but they've also been thorough with the speakers, and they have, in fact, provided each of them with a list of topics that they would like covered. And if you don't mind, because of Bill's thoroughness, I'd like to take my list out on this piece of paper. I have it right here. Topics he would like covered, let's see. If you give me a minute, I'll go over it. 177 ways to address an envelope. 1,614 ways to lick a stamp, 165 ways to cash a check, 37 things you should know about the UPS, my favorite headlines, my favorite subheads, why direct mail is better than sex. Well, thank you. And all seriously, though, I know that you probably realize by now, and I think I speak for the other speakers here, we take what we do very seriously, and we take helping you very seriously. We don't take ourselves very seriously, however, and that keeps us sane, except for some of us who it hasn't kept very sane. Bill seriously did ask us to speak a little bit about ourselves, which I think is a good idea, so I'd like to tell you a little bit about my background. I started in traditional advertising at Ogilvy & Mather in New York City, and as Ted said, I did all the things that we're going to teach you here not to do. It was a good lesson in communication because it was Ogilvy and Mather, but they don't track results, as Ted said. They try to win awards, basically, rather than to get results. So after working there and after working at a lot of other different agencies, I finally realized there was more to life than selling people with ads and TV commercials. You could also sell them with direct mail, telemarketing, 900 numbers. So I left advertising and became, as my wife takes perverse delight in saying, a junk mail writer. She likes to really rub that in and tell people, yes, he's the one that fills your mailbox with all that stuff that you don't want to get. But to paraphrase the Saturday Night Live skit, direct mail been very, very good to me. It's enabled me to work when and where I want. Right now, that's in Richmond, Virginia. It's enabled me to make more money than I'd be able to make working for someone else at an ad agency. It's enabled me to come to places like Hot Springs and Key West and meet interesting people like yourself and be able to call that work. Knowing about direct mail has enabled me to publish my own book. So now, instead of saying that her husband is a junk mail writer, my wife can say that her husband is a published author. But I think most of all, direct mail has enabled me to feel like I have control over my life. Because as long as I know that I can help other people make money, and as long as I know that I can make money through direct mail, I'll always have the money that I need. I'll always have a way to earn a living. And that's a very secure feeling. And something that you all should leave here with today is that feeling of control over your life, that you can control where you want to be, what you want to do, how much money you want to make. When I first went into direct response, since I came from an ad agency background, I was a little nervous in terms of, did I have what it takes to make it in direct response? Because direct mail, direct response, you find out very quickly whether you have what it takes or not, because you get a response or you don't. The coupons come in, the telephone calls come in, or there's just deafening silence. In advertising, you just send it out, and it's image advertising, it doesn't have to do anything. So I remember one day I was listening to a speech by a guy named Chase Revell, who a lot of you probably know, founded Entrepreneur Magazine. He's done a lot of really successful direct mail ventures, Kubrick, Zirconian Diamonds, things like that. Someone asked him, what does it take to be a success in the direct mail business? And I really paid close attention. I was listening to this, and I was just praying, you know, please, don't let it be like you have to be 6 feet tall, or, you know, you have to be from Ohio or something like that. And he thought about it for a while, and he said, you know what it takes, really, is sensitivity. And I thought, yeah, what an interesting answer, because, of course, you know, you can have all the tools, but if you don't know how to use the tools, if you're not sensitive enough to know what tool to use in what situation, they don't do you any good. You can have the experience, but if you can't apply that experience, that doesn't do you any good. So, really, what I'm going to talk about today has more to do with the sensitivity. Sensitivity in terms of what's going on in the world around you, how that affects people's psychology, and how that affects what people buy. And that's why this is called the new marketing realities, because my contention is that the world really has changed dramatically, even in the past few years. A marketing plan drawn up just a few years ago is going to be very powerfully over date. Marketing ideas from just a few years ago are very out of date. Because marketing doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, a lot of people think that they can work out of their little office or their little home and never go outside, never read all the things that Bill was talking about you should read, and they're operating in a vacuum. And you can't. You need a context, because that's what determines what you do and what you don't do. Different things work at different times. The context is determined by the world situation, what's going on in the world, by the social and economic situation. Obviously, that's having a big impact right now. And all these things affect what people buy and how they buy it and how you should sell it to them. The marketing implications of all this equal what I call the new marketing realities that you have to be aware of in order to sell today. I wanted to look first at the influences that affect these new marketing realities. One of the main ones is there's no more USSR. We don't have an enemy anymore. Japan, instead of being our friend, has kind of become an economic enemy with all the Japan bashing. Global instability. There seems to be a war everywhere you look, or a new country forming everywhere you look. Lack of economic growth. Used to be it looked like the economy would just grow forever, and this affected people's mindsets. It affected how they bought things, why they bought things, when they bought things. Healthcare crisis. No one is quite sure anymore if they're going to be able to afford to go to the hospital. That affects people. Job insecurity instead of job security. People don't feel like they know where the next paycheck is going to come from, if they're still going to have that job that's going to enable them to pay for your direct mail product. Banks, savings and loans, insurance companies, you can't even depend on them anymore. They go under every day. Politics, no one trusts the politicians, not that they ever did really, but it seems like today even more there's that distrust of the whole system. And of course things like the rioting in LA affect people very much. I want to read something to you. It's a little excerpt from two articles. One's from Time and one is from Newsweek, about how the world is changing. From Time: "The sense of unique American virtue and the American place in the scheme of things has grown deeply confused in the rapid evolution of a much-changed world. Since the end of World War II, Americans have known themselves as the giants of the free world, the dominant economic power, and the force of good in counterweight to the force of evil in the Soviet Union. Americans are now trying to assimilate the dissolution of the Soviet Union. If it is such a splendid event, why are we so obscurely depressed by it? In part because it makes us ask, who are we now? What is our purpose in life? Why are we exceptional? In the New World, America is economically challenged by Japan and Germany, the powers it defeated in war. At the same time, massive infusions of new immigrant genes confuse and disconcert people who must think of themselves as a tribe that has been formed by an idea. The conviction runs deep that Americans' lives are getting worse and worse and will never get better again, that the American dream is over." And from Newsweek: "The pleasure of the early post-war decades was that people spent beyond their expectations. There was more of everything from housing to Medicaid than people had anticipated. Now the reverse is true. Our needs constantly seem to outrun our incomes, government deficits, soaring health care costs, and heavily indebted consumers all reflect the same squeeze. The end of the American dream, the end of people's expectations. That's what we've got to form our marketing. That's what we've got to form our message to address. Maybe that's to give them new dreams and new hopes and new expectations with what we're trying to sell. But we've got to be conscious of what's going on. It affects people psychologically in the sense that there's insecurity now. People are fearful and they don't feel like they're in control of their lives. If you can offer products, if you can offer them in a way that make them feel more secure, less fearful, and more in control of their lives, these things are going to sell during these times. Faith Popcorn, and yes, that is her real name, in her book, The Popcorn Report, she was the first one to coin the phrase cocooning, people going inside their home, staying inside, wanting to feel safe, wanting to feel like they're protected by a cocoon. And she says, if anything, people are doing it more now. In fact, they're burrowing into their homes and not going out because there's just too much going on out there. When they do go out, they seek safety. They want to be in a safe environment. They want to get to where they're going in a safe way. They want to be protected. What Time calls the new frugality. People are saving money. They're not spending it. They've become planners. They don't want to go into debt. They modify what they buy. If people are sometimes, instead of buying a house, people will just get some patio furniture to make their house look nicer. Instead of buying a new suit, someone may go out and buy some accessories, a new watch, or a new necklace for a woman. They're modifying what they have rather than buying new things. One of the most important things as marketers that we have to do is to get people to believe us. That's really the first step. And right now there's what I call a crisis of belief. People are fed up with dishonest marketers, unscrupulous politicians, so they have a tendency to disbelieve first. And you've got to have that in mind when you're trying to sell them, when you're trying to market to them, that their first impulse now is going to be to not believe what you're saying. This isn't the 40s and the 50s and even the 60s where people thought, yes, because it's printed, it must be true. They know better than that now. They demand proof. And as you can see from 2020, from the expose shows, from the expose articles, there's a certain militancy even that people have. If they even feel like they're being scammed, you're going to wind up on television and being written about. Which all leads us to the new marketing realities that are going to help us avoid the pitfalls of all these things that are changing and to, of course, reap the profits that we can from them. New marketing reality number one is to get back to the basics. You know, when things change, when there's turmoil, it's always good to rest on a solid foundation of the basics. And the marketing basics are the four P's of marketing. Does anyone know what some of the four P's are? It's not green peas and sweet peas and frozen peas and canned peas. Right? Price? Product? A prospect is a good one. It's not one of the four basic ones, though. It should be. We'll add it. We'll make it five. Right, promotion and place. Exactly. Each of those has to be looked at in relation to these new realities that we're dealing with to see where the opportunities and where the pitfalls are. Product, as we touched on before, it's an opportunity to fill new needs. Like Bill is going to fill with that bulletproof vest. That's a new need that's coming up now because of the changes. Offering people security, safety, burglar alarms. And if you can't do it with a product, you can always do it with an information product that tells people how to protect themselves. It tells people how to get the safety and security that they're looking for. You've always got to look at benefits when you're looking at a product. And now more than ever, it's necessary to get back to the basic benefits of saving money, protecting yourself and your family, being healthier. A company like Sharper Image, you know who they are? They have all those electronic gadgets that you never knew you needed, like electronic way of counting your pocket change or something. They're doing really poorly now because people don't want what they perceive as luxuries. People don't want things that aren't necessities. They're very practical these days. If you're going to market a product that's a luxury, that's something that's not practical, you better be very careful about how you do it and whether you really want to do that or not. Place. You know, for a retailer, place is the stores that they have scattered around. But for us in direct mail, our place is the list that we mail to. And we have a tremendous amount of flexibility. You know, you can't move a store from one place to another very easily. But we can go from one list to another with tremendous ease. So it becomes real important now to test, as Bill was saying, to always see what lists are going to work and what lists aren't, because that changes as the situation changes, as people's psychology changes. What was a good market for you yesterday might be a bad market for you tomorrow. What was a good market for you yesterday might be a great market for you tomorrow. Segmenting your list. A lot of times with lists, people make the mistake of saying, oh, this didn't work for this list. Well, maybe it didn't. Maybe you didn't make money from that list. But maybe from a segment of that list you made money. Maybe from all the people on that list over 65. Maybe from all the people on that list that bought your product in a certain way and not another way. Maybe all the people on that list that live in California were profitable. So if you can segment your list in different ways, you can know what's profitable and you can turn something from not profitable to profitable. Experiment is a real important word. It's not really the same as test, but in a sense it is. In testing, you try to see what works and you're very methodical. In experimenting, you try things in order to see if they'll work, it's just a different mindset, and I think it's very important these days because more and more things work that you didn't expect to work. So you've got to have a kind of a mindset of experimenting. As Ted said, you've got to experiment with very small amounts of money or you'll wind up losing everything. So you always need to be careful about that. Price, obviously more important than ever these days. Always test. Price is probably one of the most important things that you should test and experiment with. Different prices. They'll fool you every time. You think you raise the price and you sell more of it. No one knows why, whether it's perceived as having a higher value. Sometimes it happens. Justifying your price is also more important than ever. People aren't just going to pay anything you ask them. They're going to want to know why. Price is not just the amount of money that you charge for your product, of course. It's also the terms. The guy I used to work with used to say, I'll pay you any price you want as long as you let me name the terms. And then, of course, his terms would be a dollar every year with no interest to be paid in St. Louis, Missouri, or something like that. Terms are a very powerful way of affecting people's perceived value of your product. Guarantee. If there's a guarantee, people are going to be less reluctant to pay the price. Discounts offered for volume purchases, for promptness, also a price strategy. And the last P, promotion, which a lot of people think that's all there is to marketing. You say, what is your marketing? And you say, and the person says, well, this is how I promote my product like this. But marketing, as you've seen, is just one slice of the pie. Flexibility of emphasis. You can change the product. It's not as easy as changing the emphasis of how you promote that product. So you can promote the product as being a higher value, as being helpful to your security, as being helping people get some of the things that they feel they need these days. How you position your product is really what we're talking about, whether it's positioned as being security-oriented or whether it's positioned as being luxury-oriented. In promotion, the new technologies now are really important because it helps get inside that cocoon that people are surrounded by. Direct mail, things like videos, get into the cocoon. People pop them into their VCRs because that's what they're doing when they're cocooning. They're watching the VCRs, watching television. So video as a promotional tool, audio cassettes they can listen to in the safety of their car, telemarketing, even faxes and computer disks are now ways of getting through the cocoon and getting to people. New marketing reality number two, and this is connected to price. Always try to think of ways you can add value to what you're doing. You know, you don't have to lower the price just because people are reluctant to pay high prices these days. You can raise the perceived value. You can raise the value of the product by offering more bells and whistles, by adding bells and whistles onto it. you can raise the value of the offer by offering bonuses, free reports, other things that go along with the product. You can offer better service, and of course you can always offer information, which is a very cost-effective way of creating very high perceived value. New marketing reality number three, try to give something away. More than ever, there's magic in the word free. In times of abundance, it's a powerful strategy. In times like this, when things are lean, it's a very, very powerful strategy. One of the reasons it works, people feel a kind of an urge to repay. That's why we don't like to go to dinner with someone and they pick up the check, because we're going to feel the urge to pick up the check the next time. You can give away what you sell if it's going to generate PR for you, if it's going to generate repeat business. You can give away bonuses, you can give away incentives, you can give away bonuses if you order a certain amount, so that encourages people to get an order like over $100. One great way of giving something away is with sweepstakes and contests, and the reason this is so interesting is because you can give away something of a very high perceived value, but you only have to give away one. But everyone has the opportunity to win it. So you can say, we're giving away a Rolls Royce, or we're giving away something that's really valuable, but you only have to give away one. But you get the publicity of giving it away and of having it. And of course, it's a powerful strategy when everyone else is cutting back and you're perceived as being generous. That's a differentiation. New marketing reality number four, obviously, build trust. So important these days. You know, it's like there's this barrier over here. And until you get over that barrier, until you get over that barrier of disbelief and distrust, everything that you say till you get to it really should go into making that person believe what you're saying. And you do that by saying things that the person already agrees with. These are hard times, and they're nodding. You know, things are tough, everyone wants to make more money. Yes, that's true. You feel this, you feel that. You know, George Bush is president. Yes, yes, yes. They're nodding along. And then you can start, when you get over that barrier, of saying things about yourself, your product, what you're offering. And they're still kind of nodding along because what you've said before made sense. Why shouldn't this make sense? Testimonials and guarantees, a very powerful way to get over that belief hump. Getting people to say things about your product, guaranteeing your product. If you're going to stand behind your product, that's one more reason that people have to trust you. They feel like they can get their money back. Of course, always tell why. Tell why your price is what it is. Tell why your quality is what it is. People have to know that these days. If you don't offer that, if you don't offer them the information, they're going to run down to somewhere. People know where they can get things now for less. Consumers are becoming very savvy. So you've got to tell them why yours is better, why they should buy from you. Number five, build relationships. The best way to build trust is to build a relationship with someone. John Eager is going to talk to you about the two-step process of marketing, which is very much about building a relationship, starting with a small ad, sending them a letter. You start creating a dialogue with people. You start creating a database, create and work your database with your best customers and prospects. The old 80-20 rule, 80% of your business is going to come from 20% of your customers and prospects. If they're in a database, if you're building relationships with them, you can maximize the profits that you can get from those people. New marketing reality number six, use marketing leverage. In these times of limited resources, does anyone here not have limited resources? Anybody here dealing with unlimited? Okay. You need to ask yourself, who can help me market my product? People like your customers. Your customers are a great source for referrals. Your customers are a great source for repeat business. They're someone that can help you market your product. Other businesses might do an endorsed mailing for you. They might let you piggyback along with their mailings your product. That's free marketing for you. You just pay them from the results of it. Any kind of a joint venture. Even the competition, quote, competition, can be a source of marketing help for you, can be a source of resources if you can work together on certain things. New marketing reality number seven, take advantage of disadvantage. One thing that is in unlimited supply these days is disadvantage. We all have disadvantages. We're too small, we're too big, we're too this, we're too that. The economy is not good. Some of the biggest successes in marketing have been companies that have turned disadvantage into advantage. People like Avis. was Avis was number two in the rent-a-car market, and they thought, how can we turn that into an advantage? And they came up with, of course, Avis, we're number two, but we try hard. Right. Absolute Vodka, when that first came out, marketing researchers said, you know, your name is kind of weird, Absolute Vodka, and your origin is Swedish, which is really no place for a vodka to be from, and your bottle is kind of weirdly, you know, it's not shaped like vodka is supposed to be shaped. And they must have listened to a guy named Joe Cosman who said, if you can't change it, promote it. So they did promote it, and all the advertising they do now highlights the word Absolute, you know, it's Absolute San Francisco, Absolute Christmas. It highlights the name, it highlights their Swedish origin, and it's a great big picture of the bottle. So they took all the things that were supposed to be negatives and turned them into positives. We can do the same thing by thinking differently about what is a, quote, disadvantage. The negative, you know, the economy being the way it is not a disadvantage if you're selling something that helps people make money even in a bad economy. The riots in LA are not a disadvantage if you're selling Bill's bulletproof vests. You can always find a way with marketing to turn disadvantage into advantage. And lastly, number eight, never stop marketing. I think Ted really put this very well when he talked about, you know, the failures come, and if you invest little enough in them, you can turn those failures into successes. You can turn your successes into bigger successes. A lot of people, they start marketing and they get busy. They get business and they put their marketing on autopilot. They just keep doing what they've done that's, you know, got the money coming in, and the money sort of comes in, the marketing's on autopilot, they're sending out that same letter, they're sending out the same package. Jay Abraham talks about building your marketing on many pillars. So instead of resting on one pillar, you've got a lot of different pillars. So if one of those pillars gets kicked out from under you by the economy, by some riots in LA, by something happening somewhere, your marketing is still going to be held up because it's built on a lot of different pillars. And that means testing a lot of different campaigns, even when it doesn't seem like there's any reason to test. So you'll have a couple of backups ready. The Karen and Linda and Jim should have distributed some handouts to you that I'd like to go through with you and kind of show you what's in there. The first page, and yell if your pagination isn't the same as mine, is some key points, some of which I think I actually covered in the past few minutes. The next page is the quotes that I read, which I think you should have and burn on your marketing subconscious. Now, the next couple of pages, it's a grid. I think grids are a great way of looking at new ideas in relation to your business. So because you can see how systematically go through how things intermesh with each other. So I've taken some of the new marketing realities and made that the horizontal grid, and some of the business things that you've got, operations, marketing, service, new products, whatever, just to see how each of those things relates in that square. So one of them, it's two pages, and I've done it for you, and then the next two pages are blank so that you can fill them in yourself. And if you need help doing that, I'm glad to, you know, work with you during this week on that. The next page is about me and some of the things I do, and the only reason, of course, that I included that is to exemplify the lesson of never pass up an opportunity to promote yourself and your products and your services. Speaking of which, the next page is, Bill asked me to bring some copies of the book with me and to do a direct mail piece for you that tried to sell you the book so that we could look at how a direct mail piece actually works for a product that someone is trying to sell. So that's what this is. And the book is Karen Sitter's Million Dollar Marketing Secrets. The little pre-head across the top, finally you can stop worrying about the economy and start profiting from it, gives the two aspects of it. Some people like to stop worrying. They don't want to have to worry about the economy. Other people have a positive point of view. They want to start profiting from it. So I've got both angles covered there. Million Dollar Marketing Secrets was a very intentional name. Million Dollar, you know, connotes value. And of course, a lot of people have made millions of dollars from the ideas in the book. Marketing Secrets. Secrets is always a nice word to use. It implies something unknown that's going to be revealed to you. And of course, Million Dollar Marketing Secrets is probably a lot better than calling it very valuable, not so well-known marketing techniques. the way you title things can be very important, and it can have a lot to do with, you know, whether something sells or not. Bob Marsden tells the story, some of you have probably heard, about this book that he had called The Entrepreneur's Guide to Business or something like that. Sold zero copies. Changed the title to Why SOBs Succeed and Nice Guys Fail in Business, and it sold about 1 million copies of the exact same book. The only thing that changed was the cover and the title. Dear Group M seminar attendee, it's addressed directly to you, which is important. You've got to make people feel like they're talking to you. And then it goes through some of the, a lot of the things that we've talked about. It talks about what's going on in the economy and the business world.
Wait, David, why don't you read it? Or read at least the first page, because there's, you know, I can see already the very first line is a key point in any offer.
Okay.
I mean, the very, very first line is something you got to do immediately, and that's get the reader involved. Because if you don't get him involved, he's not going to read it, and it's going to end up in the trash can. So why don't you just read the first page, and everybody read along with him, and make mental notes of what he's doing here. I mean, this is not just words on a page. This is an attempt by a world-class copywriter to convince a reader, which is going to be you, to purchase stuff. And as most of you will be doing, writing direct mail pieces, this is a gem. The front page is just great. Go ahead and read it.
Thank you. As I'm reading, I'd like you to be aware, I think, just of how I'm setting up a problem and I'm offering a solution to that problem. I think that's always an important format in advertising and direct mail. Would you consider going out in a raging snowstorm without being properly dressed? Of course not. And yet every day millions of business people plunge unprepared into one of the most unpredictable, tempestuous business climates we've ever seen. Is protection available? Is it possible, in fact, to revel in such conditions, like a child at the first snowfall? Of course it is. This country's greatest fortunes have been made during difficult times. Why? Because difficult times bring change, and change brings opportunity if you know how to spot it and how to profit from it. David Deutsch's breakthrough new book, Million Dollar Marketing Secrets, is the guide you need to understand and profit from these changing times. In it, you'll find out how to take advantage of crucial trends that are revolutionizing the way customers buy and you must market in the 1990s. The insider marketing secrets, which today are indispensable to the success of any business venture, and hundreds of money-making tips, tricks, techniques, and strategies that will enable you to make money in good times, bad times, anytime. Here are just some of the ideas you'll find in Million Dollar Marketing Secrets, any one of which could easily mean, and you'll notice just a little technique there, I've broken in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of an idea, but it's kind of an interesting idea. It could mean what? It forces you to turn the page.
While you're looking at this, I want you to notice that he has not ended a single page in this letter with a period. Every single page has something that makes you go. If you end a page with a period, you're giving the guy the opportunity to put the letter down and walk away. You'll notice that in Gary's letter, he absolutely never ends a page with a period or at the end of a paragraph. He always drags you into the next page. You're forced to read it, and that's the difference between good writing and bad. You can't stop it. And the other thing you need to notice is this reads real well out loud. If you write a letter or a direct mail piece and you read it out loud and you're having problems reading it out loud, it's going to fail. Because a lot of people who get it are actually going to read it out loud to themselves. I mean, their lips don't move, but they are mentally reading it out loud. And if you have problems stumbling over words or ideas, so will the same person you're sending this to. So the fact that David can sit and read this thing and it flows just like a TV script is really good. I mean, it's one of the reasons David is what he is.
One trick in that regard, too, is even give it to someone else to read, preferably someone that's like 12 or 14. If they can read your copy without rehearsing it first, without stumbling over it, and understand what it means, you're in good shape. What follows is a long list of the benefits, the different ideas that are in the book, with just enough to kind of get you interested in the idea and the benefits of it without giving away too much of it. You'll notice a lot of the book offers from people like Rodale Press that are written by Eugene Schwartz. A lot of Eugene Schwartz's own stuff from Instant Improvement will have pages like this of bulleted points of what's in the book, and also they will have the actual page numbers, which if I had some more time, I would probably go back and put in here. There's something very powerful about seeing, you know, on page 168, you will learn blah, blah, blah. You know, 5 ways to improve pricing without cutting prices. See page, 203. It gives you an idea of the depth of the book it's just a little more exact.
I want to point out a couple of things here. If you'll notice, look at the font that he's using. Font is the character style he's using on page 1 and all the way through. Anytime you get junk mail, we won't call this junk mail, but anytime you get mail like this from anybody, you should look at the font and you should look at the spacing. As a matter of fact, what I do is I get my ruler out and measure the space between the paragraphs. And you'll notice that Gary does this a lot. Gary really spaces out his paragraphs, and this letter is well spaced. When you look at it, it's not intimidating. I'm sure you've received letters from people, and you look at it and you say, oh, there's so much stuff to read, I don't want to read it. And that's because of the way it's spaced. And by spacing things out like this, you notice that between his points and his bullets on page 2, there's lots of spaces. That's important. You also notice that on the bottom of page 2, it gives a command. He says, next page, please. A lot of times you put go to next page or whatever, but you're telling people what to do. They finish the page, and now they need a little direction. You say, next page, please. I'll turn to the next page. Go ahead.
Just to add something to what Bill said, the typeface is Courier. It's a very typewriter-looking typeface. I don't like to use typefaces that look like a book was published because it doesn't look like I sat down on my typewriter and typed this out to you. Now, no one's going to think, yeah, I really typed out, you know, a million copies of something and sent it out to people. But there's a psychological perception of intimacy and of friendliness when something looks like this in a nice typewriter face.
What is your feeling about proportional spacing as opposed to non-proportional spacing? This seems to be non-proportional spacing.
Yes, same thing. Proportional spacing makes it look like someone didn't sit down at a typewriter.
Right. You do not want this to look like it came off a computer. That's why he doesn't have proportional spacing. You want it to have ragged edges on it. You do not want to have right justification. You don't want it to look like it came off a computer. Back in the old days when computers first came out, everybody thought, oh, it's so neat, it looks professional. You don't want it to look professional. People say, oh, this is some slick. You notice it's not on slick paper and there's no colors. I mean, if you get an envelope in your mailbox and you see 7 colors on the outside of it and all this slick stuff on it, where's that envelope going to end up? In the trash. But if you get an envelope that has your name and address typed on it, it looks like it's hand typed, with no return address or just 2 lines on a return address, what do you have to do? You got to at least open it to see what's inside. And that's, you know, that's half the battle of winning in direct mail is getting the envelope open.
You can't go wrong. As Gary says, if you just think about what a letter would look like if someone sat down at a typewriter and sent it to you, all those things that it would look like and it would have, that's what the letter should look like, and it should have a live stamp, a typewritten address space, no labels, this kind of a font, underlining, not bold, the whole thing. I saw a letter once from the Prince of England, Prince Charles, to David Ogilvy, thanking him for his work at World Wildlife Association. And obviously the Prince of England can afford all the word processors he wants. And I was so struck by this letter, because it was really obviously typed on a typewriter. I mean, you know, it was an original. You could see the indentations, and you could just see it was done on a typewriter perfectly, but it was obviously on a typewriter. And it looked so personal. It looked so intimate. You know, and to be obviously from Prince Charles, you know, it's very impressive. But I was so struck by that, how that looked and how that felt. We move from the bullets into a kind of a way of showing value, an analogy, where you help people think about something. And I'm trying to get people to think about buying this book as being like hiring a world-class marketing expert at a small fraction of the usual cost. So you've got me sitting at your side, guiding you as you do your direct mail projects, as you do your marketing, answering your questions, giving you ideas. A little bit about me, my background in terms of ad agencies, direct response, street smart entrepreneurs, taking the best of all three and combining them into the ideas in this book. Testimonials, again, the importance of belief. Testimonials from name companies like Zig Ziglar Corporation, and testimonials from just companies that sound like they're reputable companies, which of course they all are. Free bonus. Again, something, give away something free. You don't have to raise your price to do it. Give away something for free. And in this case, the free bonus is a report, how to get prospects and customers to pay for your advertising. And if you notice, there's a time limit on it. If you order within 10 days, that's just taken from what I usually have in my stuff. You've got to get people to act immediately. Procrastination is death when it comes to direct response, direct mail, any kind of sales. Procrastination is death. Anything you can do to get people to order as soon as possible, do it. It's worth it. Better than risk-free guarantee. Even if you send the book, the book is guaranteed for 60 days, send it back. Even if you send it back, you get to keep the report. You get someone thinking, my gosh, you know, I can only come out ahead on this deal. I can only come out ahead by sending this guy money. Order now, phone number with a code, with an M to make it so I know it's from Group M. Call 24 hours. You want to try to get people to call if you can. Because if they're not going to call, they're going to have to go look for a stamp and an envelope, and they're going to have to, like, you know, go to the mailbox or whatever. It's just more work. You can get encourage people to call. A P.S., of course, I'm sure it's been hammered in. You always want to have a P.S. People tend to read P.S.s. It reiterates the offer, the necessity for acting now if you want the bonus, and it also tells you the number to call again, which is followed by the better than risk-free order form. You want your order form to sound friendly. Notice it's on green paper, so you can spot it easily and fill it out easily. The coupon reiterates the offer in your voice. You know that, yes, please send me $1 Million Marketing Secrets. I understand that. I can return it. I understand I will keep the bonus report. So you've got the you're almost dictating to someone's mind how to think about this. Again, even when they're on the coupon, I still would rather they call. Even if they're in the process of filling out the coupon, one more chance for extra fast service, just dial this number, little picture of a phone. One thing I'd like to do just for a second is to kind of stand back from all this, because I think this is kind of a selling technique I'm not sure if anyone else is really going to speak about, and that is the idea of selling from the podium. The idea of selling through a seminar like this. If you have any speaking ability or any speaking interest, it's a great way, especially to sell information products, because you get in front of people, you gain credibility by talking to them, and it makes people more prone to buy what you have to sell. If it's something that we don't cover during the course of the week, because we can't cover everything, I'd be glad to talk to any of you about it. But I just wanted to kind of step back and look at what's going on, because I think that's important. One final strategy when you're selling something, and Gary is a real master of this, it's offering something of a really high perceived value that doesn't cost you a lot of money out of your pocket to offer it. But people perceive it as having real high value. And I thought about, well, what could I do to exemplify that? What could I offer you that would make this seem like a really incredible offer worth thousands of dollars or whatever, like Gary does? And I realized you're going to get a whole bunch of stuff while you're here. You know, you've got all this printed material, and you're going to, if you get the book, you're going to have that and the report. But when you go home, you may have questions, you may have marketing ideas that you want to bounce around, you may have copywriting help that you need. So I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll offer an hour of free consulting if you buy the book today. And of course, an hour of free consulting, if people literally have paid hundreds of dollars for an hour of my time, and it may be worth thousands of dollars to you in terms of mistakes that it may keep you from making or profits that it may open up to you. So I thought that might be a way to exemplify that whole idea of offering something that just makes the whole offer irresistible. The final thing is to tell people exactly how to order and what to do. So I'm going to tell you that I've got a bunch of books on the back table there to the right. I take Visa, MasterCard, checks from people with honest faces, and, of course, cash only from the likes of John Carlton and Gary Halbert. Thank you very much. I look forward to working with you.
Wait a minute. Don't sit down yet. David, you will autograph your book. Now, this is a special printing of the first printing of this book, right?
First edition, yes.
And you wrote this book by yourself. I mean, you didn't hire any ghostwriters. No. I've read the book. It's one of the best on the market. But what's interesting is that we're going to talk about product creation. And if you're looking for an example of a good product, David's book is exactly that. He wrote this at home by himself. He didn't use any expensive computer equipment. The book is well laid out. As you can see, some of the material is well laid out. And if you're asking real nice, he'll autograph it for you. Limited edition autographed copies of David's book.
Hi, David.
Yes.
I'm Brian Redfield, and I have a question on the letters that you're sending out. How important is it, have you found, to have the whole page full? In other words, if you're sending a two-page letter like this one, mm-hmm. on the second page, is it okay to have it half full, a quarter full, or is it more important to have the entire second page full, like you do in your example.
You mean a letter that ends on the second page?
Yeah, the information is visually.
Visually, I think it's just important that it look pleasing to the eye, and it look like it's easy to read, and it won't take a lot of effort to read. Nobody reads these days. And if you can make it, they can just look over the letter. So it's like, yep, look at all these bullet points. There sure is a lot of information in this book. They don't have to read every point. I don't know if that really answers your question. It should be long enough to tell your story in a way that's convincing. That's all of it. And a lot of those considerations, six pages, has to do with the printing of things. It's more economical to print a six-page letter rather than leaving that, you know, six-page blank.
Okay, so what I think what you're saying is that for your final page, regardless of how long your letter is, if half of the page is blank, that's not a problem.
No, it's only a problem.
Thank you.
If you...
What's that? Okay.
Dude, if you make it so it's if you think about the layout of it as you do it, you should fill it up, because if you make it so that people can get the main points from subheads, more information can only help you, not hurt you, because it won't prevent them from reading it.
Good.
Yeah.
Question, chicken before the egg or egg before the chicken. If you were tying in a seminar with a particular product, zeroing in on a business association or a group of business people, would you introduce the letter first through direct mail, or would you introduce the seminar first?
If you wanted to sell through a seminar to a group of business
Correct.
People. Yeah, I would do the seminar first.
You would do the seminar.
Yeah, this way of doing it with the letter is simply because the letter was a convenient way of exemplifying some direct mail techniques. If you're, quote, selling from the podium, there are other ways to do that without including a letter in your materials like that.
David, I was wondering why you didn't put the price in the letter itself, in the body of the letter. Would you do that ordinarily as well as the order form, or...?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I didn't really have a reason for leaving it out or not. Sometimes it's real important to justify the price. If the price were, you know, if it was, you know, Ted's $7,000 seminar, I would probably build up the value of it first and say, if you wanted to get this information yourself, you'd have to fly here and fly there and spend all these hours. It would cost you at least $100,000. But my seminar is only $7,000. For something that's $49.95, price didn't feel that important to put it in the letter.
How did you come up with the price?
I came up with the price because it was, you know, when you come up with a price, one way of doing that is to try to understand what you can sell it at a profit. So my computation was, in terms of the amount of promotion and marketing that I would have to put into selling it, $49.95 enabled me to make a price on it. It's not so high that it becomes a J. Abraham kind of product that doesn't have a real mass market to it. It's not so low that it's $19.95 and it's like a book that you're getting.
And one last question. How did you get your testimonials, and when? Did you get them before you actually printed the book, or?
Yes. I got them before I got people that had read a rough draft of it, or people that I just, you know, that I could get to look at the book a little bit as it was being done, and say, that have worked with me, and say, yeah, I've worked with David, and he's great, and his book is great. You should always be gathering testimonials. I mean, that should be such an ongoing project, is to be getting letters from the people asking for letters, whether it's for your information products, or whatever products, or for your whatever services you offer. Always be collecting testimonials. That's so important.
Hey, David?
Yes.
I'd just like to make a couple points. David has really given you some really valuable information here. You notice all the bullets he has in his letter. You should put every single bullet you could think of in a promotion, even if it's 200. I did some work for Entrepreneur magazine on an information package they had once back in the 70s. And I'll bet you we had 70 bullets in that package. And I wrote one. Remember, this is the 70s. The bullet was, fake cocaine, a legal substitute that fools almost everyone, and they're still getting calls from that bullet today. So put everything in. You never know what's going to make somebody buy. The other thing I want to say is, when I was doing my $7,000 seminars, I used all kinds of copywriters to create the material for the attendees, and nobody in the whole group was better than David Deutsch. I still owe him a debt of gratitude for the excellent work he did and very professionally and on time. And when you have an offer of something as low-priced as this, coupled with the fact that the guy is going to give you an hour's worth of consulting, if you don't buy his book here today, and I've read his book, you're not very bright.
Thank you, Gary.
Dave, you're selling this stuff to an industrial type of a customer. In other words, not somebody this direct letter is going to at a home address. Mm-hmm. Would the same rules apply as far as things like stationery and the type of package that you would send to them?
Yeah, because the business letter also, you know, has the same characteristics in terms of looking like it's personal or looking like it's not personal. It doesn't. There are some traditions in business, you know, that are a little different, and you can get away with some things. Sometimes when you're going to a business market, you're going to a smaller market, and you're selling something that's a little higher price. So you can make the package a little more complex. You can experiment with different things. But yeah, basically the same rules apply. That's something that I really wanted to bring up in the course of this. These things aren't just the consumers. The consumers aren't the only ones that are scared, frightened, feeling not in control, that are just different psychologically now. Businesses, too, are like that. So these same ideas apply very much so.
But what do you do if, for example, if you're selling a high-end, like a video product, and let's say this thing is a few hundred dollars. In most cases, these guys can't make a decision right on the spot, like if you were sending it to someone at home, we'll say, or a self-employed person. They might have to go through a series of approvals, purchasing, whatever has to be done. How do you recommend handling that?
Simply through the mails?
Yeah, I'd say that's too hard to sell. Just don't bother with them. There's too many other easy ways to make money. If you've got an audience that you know it's going to be tough to sell to, what are you going to waste your time selling stuff to them? I mean, that's the reality. You only have so much time alive on this planet and on this list of things that you can sell and of these people you can sell to. You can either pick the easiest to the easiest audience, or you can pick something tough. And what everybody does wrong is they always pick the hardest thing to sell to the hardest group of people. I mean, that's just what we all do. It's just crazy. I want to ask David a question and put him on the spot. And you can waffle on this if you want. What do you charge? I mean, what's it cost to have a four-page letter written or a six-page letter written? If somebody here has a product that they want to sell and you look at it and you say, this is a pretty interesting product, and they ask you to write a letter, I mean, what is generally does a copywriter charge, I mean, a world-class copywriter charge for something like this? I don't want to put you on the spot because I know it changes, but just to give us something in our mind, what does it cost to have a letter written if we go to you or somebody else?
A letter like this one.
Right.
Speaking for myself, I would say it would cost anywhere from $1,000 to $2,000.
That's a flat cost. There'd be no percentage on that. A lot of copywriters want a percentage. And a lot of times you want to avoid a percentage situation if you can, because you'll end up suing each other. If you sell a whole bunch, they're going to say, I want more. If you don't sell any at all, you're going to sue them because you're going to say the letter wasn't right. It's better to get a flat cost, I think.
A couple of quick questions. Dave, who is going to be your major market for this book?
The market will tell me that in a certain way. You know, I'll let the market tell me who's the market by trying different things. Right now, I would think it's small businesses, entrepreneurs, people like that. It's not a real corporate-oriented marketing textbook.
And we heard an estimate of a 1.7% response. You're going to have to do better than that to break even, I would presume, on this. What can you, from your experience, hopefully expect, or what would you like to expect as a return on your direct mail advertising?
You're talking about this particular letter in the packet to this audience?
Well, no.
I'm expecting you all to buy a copy.
Well,
it's 100%.
I presume you're going to direct market mail this or something comparable to this with your book.
Well,
1.7% doesn't seem to me to be much of a response. So
well, 1.7% isn't much of a response if you're mailing to people cold. You know, John Eager is going to talk about what I think is a better way to do that, which is to run a little ad that says that maybe offered someone a free booklet about some million-dollar marketing ideas, and then send for the booklet And then I would send them this letter along with, you know, a one or two page free report. So I'm enticing them by offering something free that qualifies them, that gives me a name, and it should yield a percentage much better than 1.7.
What would you, if I may just, so, what would you expect, what would you like to get, what would be a good return? 1.7% is the national average. Are you thinking maybe you could get 4, 5, 10%? What do you...
Sure, to either a list that I generate by some small ads or a very highly qualified list. Mailing to Jay Abraham's list, mailing to Gary's list.
Yeah, let me tell you something else about this product, and David knows that, and I know that, and Gary knows that, and almost everybody in here does direct mail does that. David didn't write this book to make money on this book. This book is just a start. I mean, the direct marketing in this book is just going to be the life of it. And what will happen is that this book will evolve and become a part of a larger product, or he'll sell the rights. Like, I'd love to buy the rights, the reprint rights from him, so I could use his book as a premium. Say, when I sell the set of tapes, I'd love to be able to include his book. And there'll be other people in this room who have products for sale that are looking for ways to add the perceived value. So you got to look at direct mail project, a product, a lot of different ways. He can sell us non-exclusive rights to reprint his book. He'd make 60 grand right now, and he still has the right to sell the book. And every time we run an ad trying to sell his book, what do? We increase the chances of everybody in this room selling that same book. Because the more ads that are out there, everybody's going to say, you know, everybody in the world is saying this is the greatest book in the world. We've got to buy it. So that's the way you got to look at this. You don't just look at saying, well, I'm only going to make 2% or 3%. And, you know, the worst part is that all of us in this room, and Gary and I and Karen, we're the worst offenders. We have videotapes that we have sold that have made us lots and lots and lots of money.